You're listening to Syntax, the podcast with the tastiest web development treats out there. Strap yourself in and get ready. Here is Scott Tolensky and Wes Boss.
Welcome to Syntax, the podcast with the tastiest, the yummiest, ooh, the most grumdiddlyumptious treats on web development around.
Yum.
Today we're going to be talking about the fundamentals. We're sort of kicking off this new series of tasty treats that is talking about what are the fundamentals, like what do you need to know before or during getting into interviewing, getting into picking up frameworks, like what is it worth knowing and at a bare minimum before you dive into these things. We'll talk about this in a second, but like people are always talking about like the fundamentals are so important, and I don't know, it's kind of an interesting place. So we're going to try to distill what are the fundamentals today of HTML and CSS. And then we've got some other topics, obviously JavaScript and maybe server side, maybe some design stuff. So we'll talk about that with me, Mr. Tolensky. How are you doing today?
I'm all over the place, man. We just recorded an episode a minute ago and I was like double talking and yeah. So I'm still getting into my routine here with our new baby, and yeah, I'm ready to go, but I'm holding on for dear life right now. So
I'm enjoying my good sleeps until ours comes, which could happen any day now.
Yeah, good luck.
Yeah, thank you. So we are sponsored by two awesome companies today. First one is Sentry. It's going to do all of your error and exception tracking, logging information about what happened, as well as FreshBooks, which is cloud accounting software for small businesses, freelancers, anybody that's got to charge some money and get paid. So let's, I thought I would just sort of like talk about it real quick. On Friday, I tweeted this thing out. I tweeted a screenshot to a Reddit thread where somebody said, just an observation, I've been interviewing candidates for a web dev position, a serious lack of knowledge in HTML and CSS. I feel like a lot of up-and-comers are rushing to cool frameworks, React, Vue, Angular. However, when tested on building a simple landing page, they fail out. I fell down this hole before. It's good for you to make sure that you have some solid understanding building blocks. And then he goes on to list some of the what he thinks are helpful. And I kind of like this thread because obviously it's somebody who is actually hiring people. Like I'm looking to hire someone and I want to. And it's sort of like a little pitfall there. So when people see this kind of thing, we all start chanting like, the fundamentals are important. The fundamentals are important. And I'm sure I've said it a million times myself, and I absolutely agree. But at a certain point, like you also, like, I understand why people are rushing into frameworks because that's what people are hiring for. And you can't just sit around like learning the fundamentals and doing this like 5-year journey to really nail the fundamentals. Like you got to get into it. And quite honestly, I didn't start with the fundamentals. Yeah. I started with trying to like shoehorn a jQuery plugin into a WordPress theme that I didn't build either of. And then I sort of backpedaled, and I wish I had done. What about you, Scott? Did you learn the fundamentals first?
No. Yeah, no, I didn't, but I learned them. And that's what's important is that you have to treat them with some degree of, well, not some degree, you have to treat them with absolute importance, but at the same time, don't treat it as like the only thing. I like to think about this in breaking. We always used to say, without a good foundation, your house will fall down in terms of like, so I, for those of you who don't know, I've been breaking or breakdancing for a long time. And the fundamentals in breaking are like musicality related. You're sort of dancing, you're doing maybe the floor work stuff where you're sort of running around on the floor, that stuff. And for people who come into breakdancing, they didn't watch that stuff and were like, well, that's why I want to learn breaking. No, they watched somebody spin on their head and they're like, that's super cool. Like, wouldn't it be cool if I could do that? And so some instructors would like scare people away because they would say, okay, you want to learn how to spin your head? Well, you need to spend 2 years just dancing without even touching the floor. And like, that's not why they're here. They're here to learn the fun stuff. And the fundamentals aren't always the fun stuff. And so regardless of what you're going to do, like you're going to say, well, just make learning the fundamentals fun. We'll put some games behind it. Like people have fun when they get into building stuff and when they see wins and they see progress, and you're not going to see progress just memorizing a bunch of syntax and names for things. And so the point here isn't that you should ignore the fundamentals. The point is that you need to learn the fundamentals, but at the same time, you need to get your hands dirty. You need to learn a little bit, but we want to talk and we want to do our very best to make learning some of these fundamentals fun in this episode as best we can, or at least give you an idea about what these fundamentals are in terms of CSS and HTML specifically.
Mm-hmm. And I was just reading through all of the replies. Obviously people have opinions all over the place on this sort of thing. And people are saying like, why do you need to know the fundamentals? I never use them. I only use this like Angular framework for doing the specific one was I just use Angular for media queries. I don't write them by hand. I just use this like Angular framework in that. And I think that's fine to use that. And I bet that you could probably figure it out once you fall back. But there's a tweet by Jean-Philippe. Oh, I'm going to butcher it. Ready? Sirios, S-I-R-O-I-S. He says, abstractions work well until they fail, and then you have to debug them. Knowledge of the core fundamentals of web is kind of a big deal. And I agree because often I see people, why is Bootstrap doing this? Have you ever, like, Wes, I'm having trouble with this, like, very specific WordPress theme.
Yeah.
And that's all I know. I only know how to build stuff on this, like, child theme subset of a very specific thing. And great, you're probably doing really well in your thing. And I definitely think that you should double down on being a specialist in that. But when things break, you definitely need to know how like a little bit of PHP works. So you definitely need to know how like media queries work under the hood so that you can debug it and not just say, why is my abstraction here not working?
Yeah, I know you see this all the time with people asking for help when they're just getting into some of this stuff. And they want to ask for help first about like, hey, I used this ID all over my website to do some styling. I used this one ID and now things are behaving oddly, or the specificity of CSS getting in the way of why is this thing being overridden or whatever. Again, we're going to be talking about so many of these things in this episode. But really, like you mentioned, the fundamentals really come into play here, not only when you have to debug, but when those tools that you're used to using aren't there anymore either. You know, Angular's not always going to be here and some other system will be. And if you understand what the core functionality behind everything is, you're never going to feel like you're lost with any of this stuff. You're going to know exactly what to do. And really the most important fundamentals in my mind in front-end web development, flat out, period, the most important ones are HTML and CSS, because the entire web is written on HTML and CSS. It's been that way for a long time and it will continue to be that way. And I know, you know, we got CSS and JS, we got JS writing everything, but JSX is still HTML in a lot of ways. So you got to know HTML, you got to know semantics.
Well, at the end of the day, if it's just outputting HTML and CSS and something goes wrong, you need to understand how it's working, right? So let's maybe jump into like what are the fundamentals. HTML is pretty simple. I think semantic markup, knowing what all of the HTML elements are, what they're used for, and like in some cases they're meaningful, like a H1 through H6 tag is meaningful, the abbreviation tag, there's the paragraph tag. Those are very meaningful. And then in some cases, they're not all that meaningful, like a div. Like, what is a div, right? Like, what is it for? And sort of like understanding what the difference is between those are two, and why would you ever use a div or something like that?
But there's also a meaning in the meaninglessness of a div, right? The fact that a div is meaningless is inherently meaningful. It's, if you think about it.
It means a lot that it is meaningless. It's like the whole null in JavaScript. It is a value of nothing.
right. It has no semantic meaning. And it's important that you need to know when you need to use something that has semantic meaning versus when you don't, aka a section, a side, any of those things that you replace, an article that you replace will typically would have been a div, the main tag. Remember when we got the main tag? That was pretty sweet. No more divs with an ID of main. Now we get the main tag.
Along with that is accessibility basics. I think that this is sort of underrated. And even in my own JavaScript course that I'm doing right now, is there's two things that I'm making sure is going to be included in my JavaScript course. It's a security and accessibility, because like these are things that should be known upfront rather than sort of looked back on later. We did an entire show on accessibility, just going into like, what are the things that you need to know about make sure you're not like accidentally being a jerk to somebody on your website who has a disability, or someone who just in general making a good website.
Yeah. Yeah. So let's get into some of the attributes that you have on HTML elements. First and foremost is the one that you see all the time is ID. And ID is most frequently misused by using multiple IDs that are the same, aka you have a div that's a main ID, and then you have another div that's a main ID, then maybe you have another one all on the same page. And you know what an ID is for? It's for an identification of a specific thing. So when you give things more than one thing's the same ID, you're sort of saying all these things are the exact same thing, which isn't correct, right? Well, an ID should be a unique thing that is only applied to one thing on the page, and that is that same thing every single time.
I also have a bunch of like class related ones here for name and action. These things make, even if you are doing your forms in JavaScript, the for name and action attributes of a form tag, knowing what they do, how you associate labels with inputs, what happens when you submit it, all those things, they make even a form submission in JavaScript, I think, much easier. Like I'm very big on using the just like regular HTML attributes in my JavaScript,
yeah.
As well as using ARIA attributes for my CSS, rather than adding a class of current or something, or adding a class of like highlighted or something like that, just go and grab whatever the equivalent ARIA one is and then use that to actually style this thing, because then you're killing two birds with one stone. You're making it accessible, and then you don't have to manage these like weird classes of like highlight or whatever.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's that's an interesting thing that I think is lost on a lot of newer people, that they may not even know that you can use those to target an item in CSS. And so they might think they might reach for a class right away. And a class is one of those things that we use mostly just to use, just to assign CSS. And so that's just another one of these huge foundational elements is a class. Now, classes, unlike IDs, can be used all over the place. And classes are really just you're denoting something, what it is, and you can use that class as a selector, as we'll get in what a selector is in the next section in your CSS, to identify some visual attributes to this thing. Okay. So the HTML side of thing, it seems like there's not a whole ton here, right? You have accessibility, you have attributes, you have semantics, but each one of those categories is pretty deep, a pretty deep well. I mean, specifically, you could spend probably an entire 30-minute episode talking about form, HTML form best practices, because forms are difficult in HTML, and you got to know how everything sort of works and functions and should be done so that you're building an accessible form, you're building a form that can be used by everybody, and you're building a form that is just well-structured and you know, just correct. But HTML overall is like that. If you're using the right semantic templates and right semantic tags and all those things, you're inherently starting to build a more accessible website for screen readers, for things that utilize and use those semantics the way they're designed to be used.
You know what's one thing that drives me nuts when we're talking about IDs here is people think like IDs are bad. And so they never use an ID anywhere because classes can be reusable. And often I get this when I'm trying to link somebody to like a paragraph that's partway down through a page. And I was like, oh, I bet this H2 tag has an ID. Because if you put a hash in the URL bar and give it an ID, the browser will automatically just jump down to the element with that ID. And if your heading tags don't have those IDs, then you can't link to somebody that's partway down the page. And I find that really frustrating. I think it's probably even an accessibility thing where you're just like, let me give somebody context into this issue. And it's not possible to scroll partway down the page. So always give, or not always, but if you have the option, especially like a WordPress or a Gatsby, there's plugins that will do this. They'll just automatically generate IDs for you. That's a huge win and such an easy thing to turn on.
Word. Cool. Before we get into a fresh section of this podcast, we should take some time to talk about our sponsor, FreshBooks.
Wow.
After a non-bad transition, there you go, followed up with an actual transition.
So one little feature of FreshBooks that I want to sort of feature here is the time tracking thing. So like FreshBooks, obviously you can get invoices and expenses and things like that. But like just one part of what FreshBooks does is you can do time tracking. So if you've got a whole bunch of clients and you're sort of jumping around between them, it can be easy to forget what you've done. And it can be easy to like forget that you forget to bill a client for specific hours. I've done that myself. Or you just sort of say like, how much did I do like 2 weeks ago? And that's not really fair to your client either. So FreshBooks, the mobile app, has a sort of a client and project timer on it that you can turn on and off depending on what you're working. You have different rates for different types of stuff. So if you have a different rate for like design versus dev, you can charge different ones. I always used it just to write exactly what I had done so that when I submitted my hours at the end of the week, the person who had hired me would be able to quickly look at what I've been actually doing. It makes them feel confident, like this money's not going to waste. So check it out at freshbooks.com/syntax. That's going to get you a 30-day unrestricted free trial. And tell us, make sure you use Syntax into the How Did You Hear About Us section. That will keep them sponsoring this show. Thanks so much to FreshBooks for sponsoring.
Cool. So let's get into everybody's favorite foundational topic. And actually, to be honest, this is my personal favorite. That wasn't being facetious there. It was CSS. And I think, honestly, there's a lot here in terms of CSS. But one of the things that is one of the most foundational elements of CSS besides the syntax is specificity, right?
Specificity.
Yeah. And did you notice that I said it correctly? I've been saying it correctly all the time. So.
Specificity? Specificity?
No.
How do you say it? Say it again.
I can't tell if you're punking me, man. What's his name?
Specificity and
no,
ternary. Ternary. I can't say it.
I don't believe you anymore. So, I really don't believe you.
Say it again.
Specificity.
Specificity. Not sure that's right there, Scott.
Somebody told me the city part. You got to say city. Specificity.
Specificity. And that's really,
it really unlocked it for me. It opened the door. It was like, here's the bank vault. It's wide open. Now you get to say specificity for you correctly.
What is specificity?
Gosh darn it, man. So this is which the order in which CSS properties and design component things are applied. Design component things. The way that the visual components are applied to your elements. And so specificity follows basically a little bit of a pattern here in terms of order of operations. Because what happens is that people will have a class name something and they'll target it with the class and say, all right, this gets a color of red. And then they'll also have an ID on that thing. And maybe they have color of blue on the ID. And they'll be like, why isn't this thing red? What's going on here? Because different topics and different selectors in CSS have different levels of specificity. Do you want to get into some of those levels?
I honestly don't even know what they are off the top of my head. I know that like
fundamentals, man.
Well, I think in my mind, I know that like you have an element selector and then you have something with a class, and you have something with multiple classes, and you have something with an ID. And then also depending on like where they are they inline? Are they in a style tag? Are they in a CSS file? If there's something with the same specificity, does one come later? And it just sort of having a general idea of like anytime someone posts one of those quizzes on like which one is more specific and they post like this really obtuse selector, I always get it right. I don't know what the rules are under the hood. I know that like a class gives it like a 1 point and like an ID gives it 2 points or something like that. But as a general like, rule of thumb, I know that I can like look at a selector and understand which one will be applied and unapplied. And then also if you're running into like specificity issues, you know that you're probably writing some terrible JavaScript or some terrible CSS, and you need to sort of reevaluate why your selectors are looking like that.
Oh my God. I really can't tell. I can't tell, man.
It's a disease.
It's a disease.
Specificity.
It's a specificity. Specificity disease.
Do you know the rules?
Well, I don't know the whole point system out of hand, but I know that you know, an ID is going to override a class, and important is going to override an ID.
Multiple classes.
An element, like if you're going to say H1 has the color of red, that's the least specific. Then a class is going to be more specific. So an H1 with a class of something, then an H1 with an ID of something is going to be even more specific. Mm-hmm. And then styling directly, inline styles, is going to be more specific if you're just applying the style directly to the element in the HTML. And then you have the important tag, lastly, which is on top of everything, with the exception being if you have another important targeting the exact same thing further down in your code.
You have a more specific important tag selector.
Right. Well, and that really highlights something. You know, the important tag really should not be used often. Like, the only time you should be using the important tag is if you're overriding some foreign CSS that's coming in from like a library, and you're only doing that in maybe one spot. It shouldn't be used for anything global. It shouldn't be used for anything. Important tags overall, like, my rule of thumb is do not use important tags. Now, you could tell me I'm wrong about that. I don't really care. I personally, that's my own personal rule. Do not use important tags, because they do nothing but hurt feelings and cause problems down the line. Yeah.
Yeah. It's like a last ditch effort to throw it on there. I've definitely been there. I have it in one of my courses where I think it's my CSS grid course, where I'm like, screw it. I just threw an important on it because I couldn't figure it out. And everybody howls at that because they're like, oh, it's good to hear that you do that too. It's like, that's a Friday afternoon, 4:45 PM fix.
Yeah. I don't use it, but I can't, I've been on code. When I was a junior dev, when I first got my like coding job, you know, you're a junior dev, you get all the projects that none of the other people wanted to work on at an agency. It's like, all right, we can now pass off all of the ones that we've been trying to get rid of onto the new guy. And like, one of them was just awful in terms of CSS, because it had been passed around for different devs for maybe like 5 or 6 years. And the thing was all flat HTML files. It was almost like you couldn't write a single property in HTML without using an important tag, because someone had used an important tag at some point down the line and then patched and patched and patched. And then you're just like, well, I have to write, like, important has just become a part of the syntax for this website because that's the only way the CSS is getting applied. And can you imagine looking at that CSS that's like 6 years old and being like, let's rewrite this and not break anything? That would not happen. So part of the CSS specificity fundamental learnings thing, the reason why it's important to understand the specificity overall with CSS, or even the CSS fundamentals, is because the longer and longer you take to apply good foundational fundamentals on your CSS, the longer you take, the worse your CSS is going to get, and the tremendously almost monumental task it will be to rip it out at some other time.
Yeah, you can't undo it.
You will hate your life. Yeah.
Yeah. Been there. And we only know that from experience, where like, you go into something too big without spending a little bit of time on learning it. Next one we have here is selectors. So knowing, you don't have to know all of the different, I think there's like probably like 15 different ways to write selectors. You've got class selectors and element selectors and descendant selectors and direct descendant selectors and sibling selectors and future selectors and attribute selectors. So like, you probably don't need to know absolutely all of them, but I would definitely say class selectors, ID selectors, descendant, direct descendant. Did I say attribute selectors? Things like aria dash, I forget, I don't even know what they are right now. I look them up every time I need them, but like aria dash open or aria dash selected, and just things like disabled selector. So knowing how attribute selectors work can definitely be handy.
Yeah, super handy. Yeah, I think it's funny because the word selector might scare people, but selector, you're just selecting something. You're saying, hey, I'm going to go pick something. And knowing those foundational terms, the syntactical terms like selectors, I think that's an important thing to have. But if you dive into saying, hey, use selectors before you're talking about what a selector even is, then I think
why you need to select something. That's another issue that we have. I'm doing that with my JavaScript course right now. Like, you often have to pedal back and not just show somebody like what a variable is or what something, I can't even think of an example right now, but like often have to pedal back and say like, this is why we need to learn this, and not just this is this thing. And because people don't learn well when they don't understand like, why do I need to use something.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. And I think that goes a lot of the time for jargon. People want to get into jargon or syntactical names for things before they understand why they need them or why they need to know what the heck they are. But selector is just like properties and any of those other things in CSS are terms you're going to want to need to know so that when people like Wes and I are saying the word selector, you actually know what we're talking about rather than just being like, oh yeah, that's CSS selector. I think so in modern CSS, this has changed quite a bit between using these new tools. But I think the next thing is going to be foundational understanding of setting up layouts. And now layouts, there's a lot of stuff that goes into layouts. And some of this stuff is very closely related to every other topic that we're going to be talking about for the rest of this episode here. But in 2019, we have more options for layouts in CSS than we've ever had before. When I started web dev, it was pretty much, okay, you have percentage-based units and you have floats. So, and tables, you have tables too. So good luck making a layout. You can float things, but you need to clear fix them. You can use a table, but you should never have done that anyways. And those were the options. But now in 2019, we have Flexbox and Grid. And Flexbox and Grid, to me, make way more sense than floating with a layout ever did, because with floats, like I mentioned, it takes something out of the flow of the document. So you have to clear fix. You have to change the height, or you have to allow the height of its parent container to reset.
Like, yeah, all such of a these nightmare.
Caveats that you have to teach somebody who doesn't even know what the heck they're doing. And you wonder why people hate CSS because of things like this. But with Flexbox and Grid, you're basically just saying, hey, this is how this stuff should work. Here's a flex container. The items in it are going to flex. Here's a grid container. The items in it are going to adhere to this grid that you're designing. And to me, a layout in 2019 is one of those things that the foundational elements of layout in CSS is just infinitely more friendly to new developers and people learning the foundation.
Yeah. And so I think you should know part of the fundamentals. You should know how to do basic layouts in Flexbox and Grid. You don't need to go into the super nitty gritty of nested grids, and in future we'll have subgrid and like, I don't know, like what's the repeat auto fit min max, like all of the intricacies of that, but like a basic grid of putting a couple elements beside each other, maybe changing them at a breakpoint. And I think that's probably good enough for your fundamentals. Anything more than that, you'll pick up when you need it. I go through my course or whatever if you need it, but it's not something that is totally necessary, because I think like the easiest 20% of Flexbox and Grid is what I use almost like 80% of the time. And then all of that sort of edge casey stuff, like custom layouts and wrapping and changing the going from row to column to row reverse in Flexbox, all of that stuff is like I maybe use a couple times a year. So just knowing the basics of it and not sweating the nitty gritty of it.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. It's like one of those things. Look it up when you need it. Learn the basics. Learn why they exist and how to use them. But don't memorize all of the little properties. You don't need to memorize all of the properties. A lot of the memorization that happens with some of these things just happens over time anyways. You can make flashcards for yourself and learn these things. But to be honest, I think you'll probably learn it faster the more you just try it and use it. Next up we have is the box model, which is really one of the most important parts of CSS, is understanding that everything you have sort of follows this model of a box. You have a box, and how the spacing, padding, margin, borders, all of the things related to that box, how they affect the size of that box is the box model. And so this is a concept that I think people maybe ignore when they're first learning. Sometimes, you know, not saying all the time, sometimes people ignore this when they're first learning and they maybe give something a width and they give it a border and they don't understand why the results are what they are. And I think the box model is easiest to be understood by looking at a picture. And one of the coolest things that we have for us in our browser tools is if you inspect any element and you look at the styles tab down near at the bottom right, or however yours are set up, it should be the bottom right, is going to be a nice little diagram is a better word, of a box. And you're going to see the width of the thing, you're going to see the padding, the margins, the border, and you're going to see how all of those affect the actual shape of that box.
Yeah, I think like between understanding the box model and understanding positioning, I think I had the most enlightenment in CSS. Because
I think block, inline, block too.
Yeah, that's true as well, because it's three. So frustrating when you can't get it to freaking go where you want it to go, or like why does the 60 and 40% thing not line up together? They add up to 100, yeah. Right? And there's all these sort of like little gotchas, and then some projects, almost all projects will use border box now.
Yes.
But you may be in a interview question where they don't give you that or something like that. That's kind of like a sneaky interview question I think someone might throw your way. And I don't think it's that difficult to understand. You know that you have an element, it's maybe 500 pixels, and that element might have padding, it might have border, and it might have margin. And the question is, do those things, padding, border, and margin, do they make the box bigger, or do they eat into the 500 pixels of that box? And that depends on what your border box is set to in your CSS. So it's pretty simple. Do a couple examples and you'll have it down pat.
Yeah. Yeah. Border box for life, as you have written in here. Ever since there was like that Paul Irish post way back when he was like, this is border box and this is why you should use it. And here's a little snippet to add it to your site. I think that might have been one of the greatest days in my web development life, because I suddenly did not have any more issues with the border box functioning the way that I would have expected it. It's like border box, like so many CSS woes for beginners could have been solved if border box was the default out of the box.
We should do like a kids these days.
Get off,
you know,
my
that
lawn.
There's like that meme, like some of y'all never have coded regular border box, and it shows, you know, that like, and it shows. We should do like a whole episode of like y'all taking your web fonts for granted. It's just like things, the olden days of web development.
I don't understand what the heck a coupon was.
Yeah. That would be a great show. We should put that on the list. If you, as I know, like a lot of people listening have been devving for over 10 years. So if you have some of those things that you used to have to do that were so painful, tweet us at SyntaxFM and at WestBoss and at Estilency, because we'll put a whole show together of those funny things.
Yeah, painful CSS. I'm all about it. All about it. I'm also all about one of our sponsors, which Wes and I have both been using for a long time, which is Sentry at sentry.io. Now, Sentry is going to be the place where you can track all of your errors and exceptions. You're writing some code, your user does this thing, and it breaks your site. Well, Sentry is going to log it for you. And they're going to categorize it. Well, they're going to catalog it, not categorize it. You can categorize it by your release or by the operating system. You can see exactly all of that sweet, sweet information that you need to know to solve these bugs. So if you write any code that is being used by any number of people, notice how I'm using the word any. It's really going to be one of those things that is going to save your butt constantly, allow you to solve all of the bugs, allow you to give you that sweet information, which without having to email your customer who reported the bug and say, excuse me, but what browser are you on? Because this is going to let you know exactly what browser they were on, and it's going to allow you to solve that problem. So head on over to Sentry at sentry.io. Use the coupon code TASTYTREAT, all lowercase, all one word, and you will get 2 months for free. Highly recommend checking it out. Sentry at sentry.io. Thank you so much to Sentry for sponsoring this episode of Syntax, talking about the fundamentals here.
Next, we have, as part of the fundamentals, one thing you absolutely have to nail and understand how it works is positioning. So a lot of the comments in this Twitter thread were saying, like, we see new developers abusing or using position absolute way too much. Because it's kind of hard to understand, like, you know, if you have trouble, top, right, bottom, left, as is, by the way, trouble. We did like a, what was the one you had? Never eat shred of wheat?
No, I said it was clockwise.
Clockwise, yeah.
What was that one, that wild concept you have? Like what reading a clock? These thing millennials, these kids up. These days, they never read a clockwise. They've never read clockwise. An analog clock.
It's true. Anyways, we had a poll on Twitter. Let me pull it up here real quick, just so I can bask in the sweetness.
No, you didn't. You won. I was winning this poll the whole time. I really feel like you gamed this if you're winning now.
Oh, damn. I just pulled it up and I did lose. I thought I won that one. So
yeah, of course you did win, because people are familiar with clocks.
No,
Didn't you even try to game that? What was the question that you asked? Let's read the question out.
I said CSS shorthand ? So we're referring to when you have shorthand and you do something like a margin or something like that. It goes top, right, bottom, left. And I always remember that by saying, stay out of trouble, TRBL. and 54% of you said, trouble was correct. 5% of you did never eat shredded wheat, which is like a compass, and 50% of you did clockwise.
Yeah.
So,
because clockwise, man,
is dumb. Who reads clocks anymore?
Yeah.
It's the coming generation, Scott. They're not going to know what clockwise is. I have to, when someone says clockwise, I have to just like sit there with my finger and pretend it's a clock.
I actually can't tell if you're making that up, but that's hilarious. I like to pull out my sundial and I like to let the sun come down and just wait a half an hour and see which direction it went. That way I know which
so
way
so out of touch it's with clockwise. Us, Scott. Anyways, yeah. What were we talking about? Positioning. It's hard to know how to position something if you've got like a div inside of another div and that parent is relative and you position absolute that thing, or you fixed and relative. So knowing how positioning works in relation to its parents and what their position are is a hard thing to get. And I definitely think that regardless of whatever framework you're using, you're going to need to learn how to use this, because I don't think there are any tricks for getting this to work. So understanding positioning, a huge fundamental you should spend some time on.
Yeah. What is absolute, relative, fixed? And now we have sticky.
Yes.
I find sticky kind of hard to use. I use it, though. We're using it on the syntax side. I use it personally. But sticky is one of those ones that I think people have wanted for a long time, and I'm happy to have it. So, positioning, I think people, we should throw static on here, too.
I didn't even say that. That's like the default.
Yeah, it's the default. And I think because if you just apply position relative to something, it doesn't do anything, you know? Mm-hmm. I feel like people might always assume that the default is position relative. And I'm projecting here, because when I was a new developer, I just assumed that the default was relative. I always just thought that, okay, you use position relative as a container for position absolute, and that's what it's for. But no, position relative allows you to position the thing relatively to where it is. So, I mean, it literally has a specific use case that's not just a container for position absolute. Or I think that's just an important thing. Again, I'm projecting some of my dev insecurities onto the audience right now. Another one we mentioned before in the HTML section is forms and inputs. Now, forms and inputs, in my mind, are one of the biggest pains in the rear ends. I got kids. I got to say rear ends. I can't say any of these other words. Is the default CSS that comes onto form inputs. Now, I think we would all hate life if CSS inputs or inputs in general had no default CSS and were just like a blank square, I suppose. But because they have some default styling, it's one of the biggest...
Inconsistently default.
Yeah. Yeah, consistently default is really the thing that needs to happen. They have styling in different browsers, and because of this, we need to make sure our inputs look nice in every single browser. But it's where some of the things, like in addition to the default styling of every other element, but where CSS resets or normalize or those things come into play. But basically, forms and inputs have some default CSS, and we need to both respect that default CSS and override it to do anything with CSS forms. And that can be a frustrating thing for people who are new to CSS.
Yeah, particularly like aligning forms or making them look like the mock-up, and also understanding. So part of what this Reddit thread was stateful HTML, and everyone's like, what the heck is stateful HTML? I was like, what is stateful HTML? He went on to explain that like your inputs can be empty. They can have placeholders. They can have text in them. They can be invalid. They can be valid. They can be
hovered.
I don't know. They could hovered.
Focus, yeah. So there's focused. Yeah.
They could focused. That's a good one. There's just a lot that goes on with interacting.
They could be visited. Remember visited links?
Oh yeah. Visited links. Did you know that visited links, you cannot, this is a bit of an aside, but I think it's interesting. You cannot get the color of a visited link via JavaScript. Did you know that?
I didn't know that. And that seems kind
of
weird.
Do you know why?
But who's using visited links anymore? I prefer Google to have all my links blue with my visited links being purple. And that's just the way you got to have it.
But the reason that you can't get the color of a visited link is because there was a hack where somebody listed every URL out there, and then they just did, what was it? Something like visited display block, and then the rest of the links were display none. And then they just grabbed the visible ones. And then you could just loop over links and say, if this link is purple, then they had visited it. And that's tricky. To that's a security issue, because then you can tell a user's browser history while they're on your own website. So you cannot get any information about visited links styling via JavaScript.
So just like I said, it's a terrible idea and it should not exist.
Well, I like it in Google, where if you've been to a search result already.
Yeah, definitely.
What else do we have here? Forms and inputs. Yeah, they're just knowing how to style them is, I think, part of the fundamentals. You don't have to get too into it, but I definitely see that like a field set tag is really underused. People are often just throwing extra divs.
Oh yeah, field set. Yeah.
When a field set is, that's what it's for. A field set is for grouping together groups of inputs. And I often will use them for as a grid container or Flexbox container. And you could also disable an entire field set. Did you know that? If you put disabled on a field set, it will disable all of the inputs inside of it.
I didn't know that, but it makes a lot of sense. And I've never really built that many complex multi-step forms or anything. So I don't know if I would have run into that, but that's really neat.
I use it on my React course, because if you want to disable an entire form when something is in loading state, then you can just wrap all of your inputs in a field set, because a form tag won't take a disabled attribute, but a field set will. And that's a kind of a cheap way to quickly turn off all of the inputs so people aren't typing into them as you're doing work.
Yeah. Interesting.
Yeah. What do we got next here?
And the next one is going to be block versus inline block in terms of what an element actually is. And this is one of those ones that I think you do need to memorize when you're first starting out. Every single HTML element out of the box has a default status, whether it's a block level element, an inline element, or an inline block element. And this really determines how the item takes up space onto the page. If it's a block level, it's always going to be the width 100% or whatever width you specify. And typically block level elements are either used, they're used as containers, a paragraph is a block level element, a H tag, heading tag, those are block level elements. They take up the whole width of the site, the application. They can be given a height. You can say it's 500 pixels tall and it's going to respect that. Then you have inline, which are going to fall in line. Typically, you see this with things like span. Span is a generic wrapper for an inline element. Anchor tags are inline elements. Let's say you have a bunch of links here and you have, one of the reasons why an anchor tag needs to be inline is that if you wrap some text that's inside of a paragraph in an anchor tag, you wouldn't want that taking up full width block level space. You would want that to be in line with the rest of the paragraph. An inline block means it has some of the properties of an inline item, as in it falls in line, but also has some of the properties of a block level item. You can give it some space and things like that. So yeah, I think this is one of the huge foundational elements that you need to memorize which components, which elements have what, and memorize what the block, inline, and inline block are all doing. And the fact that you can turn anything into anything else, right? You have an anchor tag, you want it to take up space, you could say display block. There's also another display here that we didn't have, which is display none, but it's kind of different.
There's a bunch of weird ones. Obviously, there's display flex, display grid.
Yeah.
But those are blocky. They're blockish. They do all the things that a block element do. You can give them a width and a height. There's inline flex, which is just like an inline element. There's display table, which used to be a hack for vertically centering things.
I'm inline flexing right now.
Honestly, don't even dive into all of those. Just know what block inline and inline block is, and you'll be able to extrapolate to the rest of the displays.
Yeah. Yeah.
Next up, we have sizing units. We did an entire episode on the different types of sizing units. I think that's probably just a good one to listen to if you want to sort of get up to speed. Pixels, ems, rems, what are the differences between the two? Specifically rems and ems, where something is sized based on something else that is sized in the parent. So that's what's always tricky. It's the same with absolute and relative, where something is positioned based on something else. Same with ems and rems. So knowing how those works, why you may or may not want to use pixels or percentages, things like that. And then you can get really into the weeds, turns, radians, degrees. I don't think that those are really all that necessary. Do you?
I don't, at least not for a foundational. That to me is like a very specific use case that you're looking to do. For me, I mean, it's like I think the biggest things is like pixels versus ems versus rems. Know when the difference is, know why you need to use them. Percentage versus pixels, know when to use them, know why they're there. And then just don't worry about the obscure stuff. everything else after that is essentially things that you need to learn on a per case basis or per situation, like an FR unit. Oh, well, you only need to really learn that if you're learning CSS Grid, and you should learn CSS Grid, but I wouldn't learn it in the same context in which you're using other units.
Yeah. Yeah. It's just a whole different spot, and you don't need to overwhelm yourself in it. Again, we're talking about fundamentals here. Like, what are the basics that you need to know before you jump into doing something a little bit more advanced?
Yes, sir.
Next, typography. Like, what would you say? We don't have any notes on this. Like, what do you say the basics of typography is?
For me, the basics of typography is knowing, I think I, this is going to be a weird one, but knowing about like collapsing margins gets people a lot. How margins work to me is how margins and line height work is a huge part of effective typography and vertical rhythm and all those things. So it seems like a weird answer, but one of the things that helped me the most out writing effective typography is understanding line height and margin and how it all works together.
Yeah, that collapsing margin. You want to give us a rundown? Because I bet there's a lot of people listening to be like, what's a collapsing margin?
Yeah, a collapsing margin. Okay, so let me paint you a picture here. You have a div. Inside of that div is an H1. And underneath that H1 is a paragraph tag. Now, both of these things, let's say all of them have a margin of top and bottom of one rem. All of them do. I'm just giving you some easy values here. One might think that there's a margin on the top of one rem and a margin on the bottom of one rem. And then the paragraph is going to have a margin atop and then a margin bottom one rem. So therefore, there should be a two rem difference between that H1 and that paragraph tag. But there is not. Because of how HTML works, how CSS works, not HTML, there is something called collapsing margins, where adjacent siblings, as in the H1 next to the paragraph tag, they're adjacent, or they're directly touching. Their margins, if they collide, are going to collapse into the largest possible margin. AKA, since it's just one and one on top and bottom, that's just going to be a one margin difference. And this allows you to build really consistent looking, I guess, typography systems where you're not getting those double spacing. So you're not having to do something like margin bottom zero, but only in this particular instance when there's a paragraph tag right here. So Basically, the collapsing margins is a thing where, even though there theoretically should be two rems or two double the margin there, the margins collapse into each other to form one margin. And that allows you to create these systems. Now, I in the past, when I was a junior, when I started getting into CSS, I really wanted to just eliminate all possible issues by either only setting margin bottom on things. I would just do margin top zero all, and then only set margin bottom. But once I learned to embrace collapsing margins and truly understand them, I think I write better, way better CSS, less overrides, less unique situations, because I'm letting sort of HTML and CSS do the job that it is built to do.
Mm-hmm. That's good. I'm glad that you said that. Other things, typography, sizing your headings, sizing your, like setting up like what a font stack is, setting the size of all your paragraph elements. I think that's probably the basics, maybe not even loading in external fonts, although that's not the hardest thing. I don't think it's necessarily part of the fundamentals.
Yeah.
Last thing we have here is just basic media queries. So understanding how to write what is a mobile first media query? And that is that things go from small up, and what is a desktop first media query, where you write increasingly bigger or smaller media queries as things get smaller. That's really just basic media queries. You don't need to get into the nitty-gritty of it, just understanding how it works.
Word. Cool. I think we covered it. There's probably stuff we missed. I mean, there's so much stuff here that I think it's sort of an inevitability that we may have missed something. Maybe we can do another follow-up in a hasty or something. But this HTML and CSS foundations, the fundamentals. Wes and I both turned into Larry Bird here and worked on our fundamentals for a little bit. And we're completed this. We're going to be doing, like you mentioned, a series of fundamentals episodes. Let us know if there's any topics in particular you want to see out of the fundamentals series of episodes.
I love talking about fundamentals. I often get this on Twitter where people always think, I'm like, what would you like to see included in beginner or something? And inevitably you get 100 tweets of people with like very specific, like, oh, I think blockchain cryptography is pretty important to know. And like, okay, calm down. That's not fundamentals. Like, this is bare basics. You should know as a sort of a high level thing before you start jumping into using Foundation or Bootstrap or whatever. So
see.
Let us know what you think. We're going to have one on JavaScript. Maybe even the fact that this, we put an hour into just HTML and CSS, JavaScript might need two. We'll see.
Two.
I think a server one, understanding how servers work would be interesting. And then we'll sort of see from there.
Yeah, I'm excited. I'm excited to get through all these fundamentals. This part of the show where we're gonna be talking about our sick pigs. And sick pics are things that we find to be sick, and sick isn't rad or dope or cool or any of those cool things. So, or whatever word you like to use. I don't know what the kids are using today. These dang kids. but yeah, so would you got a sick pic? I know I have one sitting around here. So
I do have one. And this is another hilarious, not totally unrelated. And it's the forearm forklift. Have you ever heard of this?
Sounds interesting.
So part of my job as a husband to my wife is my job. Constantly moving heavy things. And I also, I grew up, my parents would always buy new furniture and make me rearrange it. And I hate it so much. Lifting furniture and like heavy things and moving them around is like my most hated thing. And I'm always the guy that people call to like help them out. And I'll do it, but it sucks. So I bought these like straps many years ago called the forearm forklift. And there's these like, basically, there are these big orange straps that go underneath like a dryer or a mattress or something like that.
Exactly.
And basically you put them around your forearms and then you can just kind of lift from there. And it's so much easier to just to hold on to the thing when you have the weight close to your body rather than reaching out and lifting it. I'm sure it's going to like help your back and all kinds of stuff like that. So a big fan of these. I would definitely pick up a set next time you're at, I don't know, what's the home improvement place called?
Home Depot?
Lowe's or something? Home Depot, yeah.
Yeah,
I got them at Canadian Tire.
Wow.
Canadian Tire is like, it's like a weird, I don't even know how to describe it. They obviously sell tires.
Yeah.
They also sell
they have a maple leaf for a logo, don't they?
Yeah, it's like a hardware store, but also like a sports store. And also like tools and
that's weird.
I don't know, all kinds of very mediocre things are sold there.
But they got a forearm forklift. When you said forearm forklift, I was thinking, you know, like, no, man, not two arms, four arms, you know, like a forklift. Oh,
well,
with four,
it comes with two. So, yeah, four arms go into them.
I was thinking like an actual forklift, but like with four prongs instead of two. Like some guy was just like, you know, these two-prong forklifts, they could be twice as effective if we had two more.
Can you imagine having a forklift? I would just cruise if I had a forklift.
Just rolling through town on a forklift.
Yeah. Is that allowed? Probably not.
Probably not. Depends on, maybe, like, if you're cruising through town on a forklift for, like, 5 minutes, 10 minutes, like, yeah, sure. But, like, once it gets to, like, a whole day, I think somebody's going to be stopping you.
Yeah, I would mod mine out.
Oh, yeah. Got to put some afterburners.
What do you got for me today?
I have a show on Netflix, and this is, some people are going to hate this because it's one of those types of shows that like can make some people cringe really hard. Courtney watched one episode and was like, I'm out. I'm tapped. I can't do this. It's comedy. It's called I Think You Should Leave with Tim Robinson. And it has like some of the Lonely Island guys, like what's his name? Andy Samberg and Akiva. They produced it. And it's done by Tim Robinson, who's a comedian. You've probably seen him before on other things. He was in the show Detroiters, and it's a sketch show. And I don't know how to describe most of these sketches other than painfully awkward to the point of like, you almost like you just tense up when you watch some of it. Cause it's great. I don't know how to describe it other than the comedy is not for everyone. You'll know instantly if you watch one episode and you think the episode's funny, then this show is for you. If you watch one episode and you're like, nah, I don't know, you aren't going to like the rest of it because it almost gets worse and worse every single episode. And I've been loving this series. I binged it all the other day, and I was just in tears at some of the stuff. The episodes are quick, like 16 minutes, so it's not like you had to devote a ton of time to it. It's a sketch show the same way that like Portlandia is.
Yeah.
It's got a lot of celebrities in it. People that you've seen before from SNL around are in it. A lot of SNL people. It is great. I had a great time watching this. I'm a huge fan, and I really hope they do another season.
What's it called again?
It's called I Think You Should Leave with Tim Robinson. It's brand new.
Oh.
Yeah.
I'll check that out. That seems funny.
I've
always been disappointed. Canadian Netflix sucks.
Oh.
And it has like nothing good. So whenever it's something that's like a Netflix actual show, then we get it. And I'm always happy when there's something good.
Oh, nice. Yeah. Yeah. This was good. I've had a great time watching this show. So check it out. My shameless plug is going to be my new course on debugging and dev tools. It's live on Level Up Tutorials. If you're a pro subscriber, it should be available for you already. If you are one of the sad souls who is not a Level Up Pro subscriber, you should get on that. Head over to leveluptutorials.com/pro. Sign up and learn dev tools and debugging today. We cover just about every single tab in your Chrome dev tools and talk about what they do, how to use them properly, how to understand what the heck the information is that they're giving you. Because the more tools that you understand and know how to use, the faster you can solve any sort of problem that you're having in your web development. So if you want to save time and get those debug and dev skills up, leveluptutorials.com/pro.
Sick. I have all my courses at westboss.com/courses. I'm working on a beginner JavaScript one right now, which should be out soon. And you can go to that URL and see if it's live yet, or you can take one of my free ones. I think that's it. Thanks for tuning in. And we will catch you next week.
Cool beans.
Peace.
Peace.
Head on over to syntax.fm for a full archive of all of our shows. And don't forget to subscribe in your podcast player or drop a review if you like this show.